you, Paul Kelly, and I took in 1958, making a survey of military installations on the East Coast, which led to Harvey Oslin going out of the print shop down to Camp Lejeune. That's been a while back, hasn't it? I've been coming to Massanutta Springs with some degree of regularity since 1962, and I think it took about 6 years to work up to this auditorium. We were always able to accommodate everybody we had over across the road. I bring you greetings from Doug and Faye Koningsberg. Knowing I was going to see you, I went out on Wednesday to the project he's working on and asked him how it was going. And then I inquired around to find out. Doug, you know, is in charge of laying some water pipeline out at our headquarters. And the word I got back, the city inspectors said, we would like to hire you to teach us how to do it. The average amount of water pipeline the city lays is 200 feet a day. And Doug and his crew have made as high as 400 feet in one day. So Doug sends greetings. We appreciate your loaning him to us for this project. He's looking forward to getting back. He did tell me he keeps in pretty close touch because Papa Harvey Oslin calls him up once a week, makes sure everything's all right. Now to get on into our subject, whatever it turns out to be here this morning. When Dawson Trotman, in his latter years, traveled around, he was always pressed, of course, as he spoke, to tell the people what his topic was going to be. Well, he didn't always know until he got up on the platform what his topic was going to be, but he wanted to give an answer, so he came up with a standard answer, which was the need of the hour. So when he got up to speak, that always fit. He could publish it 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks ahead, the need of the hour. So I think I've learned a little from him, and my subject, regardless of how it's written or publicized ahead of time, is simply you. Harv and I were talking about this last night. He recalled a time we had a conference together in Japan. So whatever the subject turns out to be, the real subject is how it relates to you. And I'm trusting that everything we say this morning will in somehow relate to you and to enrich you. God doesn't love organizations or movements. He loves people. Christ loved people. They kind of got on the nerves of some of his disciples, but never on his nerves. Some of us are like the disciples, I think, more than Christ. Out in San Diego a couple weeks ago, I heard a Christian leader, he got up and told a story that took place between a mother and a son. And the son said to his mother, I'm not going back to that church. And his mother said, yes, you are going back to that church. He said, I can't go back. I'm not going back. I don't love the people, and they don't love me. I can't go back. She said, you are going to go back because you're 50 years old, and you're their pastor. In thinking about this session and trying to see how that we could compress a few thoughts into a brief time, I came up with a little thought in hanging the thoughts together, which I'm going to write on the board. This will be about the only time I'll use it. And that's my outline right there. Now, if somebody that didn't make it to meeting said, what was the subject this morning? You can say, well, it was tops. Well, I don't mean the, the quality. I'm talking about the subject matter. So we'll just reverse this, and this is the outline, maybe not the quality of what we're going to say. So I'm going to try to hang my remarks this morning on nine truths, four observations, two principles, and three suggestions. Bob Foster had a 7-pointer last night. We're going to have an 18-pointer this morning. And some of them are very, very brief. And I trust that everything we say in between the 18 will in some way illustrate or amplify one of these nine truths, four observations, two principles, and three suggestions. So, truth number one is found in John 3:16. God so loved the world. You won't disagree with that, will you? Truth number two is found in John chapter 17. And it is, Christ has the whole world on his heart. In John 17, he mentioned the world 19 times. I was attending a rodeo in Colorado Springs once. The guest star was Cliff Robertson from Hollywood. His performance was to sing the song, He's Got the Whole World in His Hand. I was sitting next to Walden Scott at the rodeo, and he said, he ought to change it just a little bit. He's got the whole world on his heart. And that is true. Everybody in the world. Bob talked last night about the Greeks and the Romans and the Jews. Everybody always has had the whole world on his heart. Bob was talking about the Greeks last night. I thought about an incident I heard of recently. You know, they had things in hand. The Greeks, the founders of democracy. In one city, democracy was so advanced that a law couldn't be passed unless the majority agreed on it, everybody in the city. And anybody could propose a law. So it was kind of unworkable. So they got a law passed that anybody who suggested a law did so on the hangman's platform with a noose around his neck. After the vote was taken, if the law passed, they took the noose off. If it didn't, they sprung the trap. And the Romans, most of their architecture had an arch or something like the ceiling here to keep the architects and the contractors honest. When the scaffolding was removed, they all had to stand under the building so you see whether or not it stood. And Diocletian in 301 A.D. passed the law that anybody who contributed to inflation through raising prices or wages had their choice between the death penalty and deportation. A lot of fascinating people. Christ loved all of them, and he loves everybody today. Now, truth number three, and we're working up to our subject here. Christ ended his time on earth in great triumph. Up until 1962, whenever I thought about Christ's last night on earth, it was with sympathy. as it seemed, he did not have a great deal to show for his 3.5 years of intensive ministry. But over in the Garden of Gethsemane, at 9 o'clock, on my first trip to the Holy Land, with a flashlight and a Bible, at the scene where he spoke the words that are given, I read John 17. And since that night, have never since felt sympathetic for him. Because that I read in verse 4, in great triumph, at the end of the 3.5 years, he said, I have finished the work which you gave me to do. He was not talking about redemption. He was talking about that which follows in verse 21 and 23. I have finished the work which you gave me to do, that the world may know, and that the world may believe. I've done something. The result of that is, it's possible for the whole world to know and to believe. He came to the end of that time in great triumph. I'm going to give you a couple of startling statistics in just a minute. I don't know whether the TV commercial that we have in Colorado Springs or not is a network thing. You can tell me whether it is or not. But there's, I think it's a Ford commercial. And the one of the two, not the straight man, is telling about the merits of the Ford. The person on the other end said, I didn't know that. Is that a network TV commercial? Okay. Now I'm going to give you a couple of startling statistics. And when I do, if this is new to you, I want your response to be, I didn't know that. Will you do that for me? Okay, now where are we here? Truth number 3. Christ ended his time on earth in great triumph. Truth number 4. His plan, his scheme, was a fantastic success. 30 years after the resurrection, in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 6, we find that Paul, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, writes this. The subject in verse 5 is the gospel. Listen carefully. Which is come unto you as it is in all the world. 30 years after the resurrection, Paul was able to write, the message of the gospel, the word of the truth of the gospel, has come into all the world. Did you know that? You didn't know that. That's what it says. Now, lest we think that's an isolated scripture, cross the page to 1:23, Colossians 1:23. The subject is the gospel, which he says, middle of the verse, which you have heard, and which was preached to every creature which is under heaven. Did you know that? Good. Colossians 1, 6 and 23. Truth number 4 is, to repeat again, that Christ's plan was a fantastic success. Now next, and this is truth number 5 from history. I want to read from the Apologeticus of Tertullian, written in 197 A.D., addressed to the Roman officials. And he said, we are but of yesterday, yet we have filled all the places you frequent. Of course, Tertullian was writing on behalf of the Christians. We filled all the places you frequent, cities, lodging houses, villages, townships, markets, the camp itself, the tribes, town councils, the palace, the senate, and the forum. All you have left that we do not occupy is your temples. I won't read all of this. It's very interesting. But now here is the fantastic statistic. He says, "For nowadays, it is owing to the multitude of Christians that your foes are fewer, since nearly all the citizens of nearly all your cities are Christians." The great Roman Empire, Tertullian said, 197 A.D., nearly all the citizens of nearly all your cities are Christians. Did you know that? 197 A.D. I'm building on the idea that Jesus Christ finished his earthly ministry in great triumph as he came up with a plan through which the world could be reached. And if I have accurately given you, that is, if the information I've given you is accurate, and I believe it is, his plan worked fantastically. Now, that was truth number five, this truth from history. Truth number six, the heart of the plan. I like the way the British describe things. You know, there's a better word than plan, and that's the scheme. I like to call this a scheme instead of a plan. Verse 6, he said, "I took the men you gave me, I gave them the words you gave me," verse 8. Verse 18, "As you sent me, I sent them. And they turned the world upside down." And 200 years after Christ, the effect was, Tertullian said, almost all the citizens in almost all your cities are Christian. The heart of Christ's scheme was this. He took some men. He concentrated on them. He sent them out. And I've given you the result. Sometime, if you want to do an interesting study, take the Gospels. Assign a time period to every incident that's recorded in the four Gospels. You know what you'll discover? More than 90% of Christ's time during that last 3.5 years is unaccounted for. More than 90% of it. But I can tell you how to account for it. And I'm going to verify this one of these days when I visit with some of the 12. And I'm going to ask the question, is it true that you were in a training program with Jesus Christ 3 summers? And I think that they will say, we didn't have the navigators in those days, so we didn't call it a summer training program. But that pretty accurately describes it. And I said, what months of the year were you involved? 9 months, like school term? 12 months. Our training is 5 days a week or so. What days of the week were you involved? 7. We devote 5 or 6, 7 hours a day. How many hours you put in? 24. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 12 months out of the year. Christ concentrated on 12 people to get them ready to do what we've talked about they did do. Expressed by an Episcopalian priest named Harton, he said, "A priest should not forget that in the midst of his ministry of the multitude, our Lord gave himself to the intensive training of the 12 upon whom he founded his church." That's what he really did. That's where the 90% of the unaccounted time went for, into these 12. Now, to hasten on, let me suggest that four things were imparted, just to mention this. I'm still on truth number 6, the heart of the plan. He gave them knowledge. He gave them skill. He gave them a relationship with himself and with each other. And he gave them character. I'd like to follow through on that a little bit. Verse 20 of John 17 tells us that Christ prayed not only for the 12, but for everybody who would come to Christ as a result of their lives. Everybody in this room this morning who's a Christian is in a genealogical descent from one of those 12. Now, do you think you'll ever put your spiritual genealogy together? Don't be embarrassed by not knowing the name of which one of the 12 is the head of that spiritual genealogy. I want to tell you a little bit about each of the 12. James, first. There were two James. But as he came to the end of his life, in 44 A.D., as James was led to the place of martyrdom, his accuser was brought to repent of his conduct by the apostle's extraordinary courage and fell down at his feet to request his pardon, professing himself to be a Christian, and resolving that James should not receive the crown of martyrdom alone. Hence they were both beheaded at the same time. Philip, the next apostle, he labored in Upper Asia. He was scourged, thrown into prison, and crucified in A.D. 1954. Matthew, Bob talked about last night. The scene of his labors, Parthia, Ethiopia, in which latter country he suffered martyrdom, being slain with a halberd in the city of Nabda, A.D. 60. James the Less, at the age of 94, he was beaten, stoned by the Jews, and finally had his brains dashed out with a fuller's club. Matthias, who replaced Judas. He was stoned at Jerusalem and beheaded. Andrew, Peter's brother. On his arrival at Edessa, he was taken and crucified on a cross, the two ends of which were fixed transversely in the ground. Hence the derivation of the term St. Andrew's cross. Mark wasn't one of the 12, but Bob mentioned last night down in Alexandria, Mark was dragged to pieces by the people of Alexandria at the great feast of Serapis, their idol, ending his life under their merciless hands. Peter. Jerome says he was crucified, his head being down and his feet upward, requiring because he said he was unworthy to be crucified in the same form and manner as his Lord was. Jude, crucified in Edessa, A.D. 72. Bartholomew, translated the Gospel of Matthew in the language of India, propagated it in that country. He was at length cruelly beaten and then crucified by the impatient idolaters. Thomas called Didymus in India, exciting the rage of the pagan priests, he was martyred by being thrust through with a spear. Simon Zelotes preached the gospel in Africa, even in Britain, in which latter country he was crucified, A.D. 1974. John, the only one of the 12, who did not die a violent death because of his faith. Christ accomplished something in these 12, in that 3.5 years, as their lives and the record of their successes testifies. Summary truth, number 7. It is said, when Jesus Christ got back to heaven, he was met by Gabriel. They talked over what he had been doing. And Gabriel was anxious. He said, now that you've made this provision, you've redeemed the human race, what's the plan through all generations to make this known? Christ said, I picked out 12, and I trained them, I entrusted it to them. And Gabriel was shocked. He said, Judas has already bailed out. Thomas, Peter. What's plan B? Christ said, no plan B. That's it. That's the plan. Now, did it work? On the basis of this information I've given, did it work? Okay. How many truths did I say I had? Nine. That's six of them. I'm going to observation number one. An observation made by D.E. Host, a successor to Hudson Taylor, directing the China Inland Mission. And I want to paraphrase something he said. When God gets ready to make an outstanding contribution to the world, he picks out a man and works out in his life the things he wants worked out in the lives of multitudes of people. And I agree with Mr. Host. That's observation number one. Observation number two. God picked out a man named Dawson Trotman that I hope you will take the time to read all about in this book that won the prize this morning, because we can't put many details in these few minutes. One of the first things God put in his heart was a burden and a love for the whole world. And if he were speaking to you here this morning, one of the questions he would ask you, I'm sure, is this. If it were possible for you to exchange your salvation for $1 million, would you make the exchange? Would you rather have $1 million or Christ? And what would your response be to him? You wouldn't exchange your relationship to Christ for $1 million, would you? And then he would come back like this. Does Christ really mean that much to you? And your answer would be yes. And he'd say, ah, God is no respecter of persons. He doesn't love you any more than he loves anybody else. And he would like for everybody in the world to be able to say that. He wants Christ to be just as precious to everybody in the world as he is to you. Dawson Trotman believed that if Jesus Christ said this message was to be carried to the whole world, it was not only a command, it was a possibility. And he started to work on it. Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of things that happened. I hope you'll read about them in the next 12 years. But after World War II was over, 1945, navigators' work kind of slowed down after the war. And some of our theologians and thinkers had a little meeting in the catacombs one day. And they said, God has miraculously blessed the navigators. We must have been doing something right. If we were doing something right, it must be in the Bible. Why don't we look in the Bible and see if we can find out what we've been doing right that God has blessed over these last 12 years? So 1945, as they were making this study, one of them ran across 2 Timothy 2:2. And then they recall the account of when Dawson Trotman met Sailor Number 1, Sailor Number 2 in 1933. Having spent some time with the first sailor, Lester Spencer, the way Christ spent time with the 12, like Andrew, who brought Peter, Les Spencer brought Gurney Harris to Dawson Trotman and said, here's a man who needs what you've been teaching me even worse than I did. How about teaching him? Trotman said, "You teach him." And Spencer said, "I could never teach him." Trotman was serious. He said, "If you can't teach him what I've taught you, I'm a failure as a teacher. I'm going to start all over again and stick with you until you can pass on to him what I've given you." That's a principle that was practiced for 12 years without being identified. And then in 1945, the fellow said, this is it. 2 Timothy 2:2. Paul said to Timothy, "The things that you've heard from me among many witnesses, the same commit to faithful men who will teach others also." Every Christian, a reproducer. One day, Dawson and Trotman and I were at the Navy Landing in Long Beach in his 1932 Packard, having a little fellowship. And he couldn't wait to open the Bible. And he said, "God's been speaking to me out of Isaiah 58. And he said, "I tremble at the implications. But," he said, "I know God said this to me. And he showed me Isaiah 58:12. And they that shall be of these shall build the old waste places. Thou shalt raise up the foundations of many generations. And thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. A foundation of many generations." God told him he was going to use him to be the foundation of many spiritual generations. Your presence here this morning is a testimony to the fact that what God purposed and what he told me that day has come into being. Now I'm going to jump to principle number one. And here's the way I would express it. Spiritual reproduction should be the normal experience of every maturing Christian. I'll say it again. Spiritual reproduction should be the normal experience of every maturing Christian. Now, if you didn't think of that before, you hadn't thought of it before, would you like to say, "I didn't know that"? Well, you already knew that. Is that what you're saying? It should be the normal experience of every maturing Christian. And if Dawson Trotman were here, among the other things he would say, reproduction, physical reproduction, is the way the earth has been populated. And as I've seen some of the families, here this week, still going on, isn't it? He said, whenever you find somebody who isn't reproducing physically, it's either because they're not married, they're diseased, or not mature. Physical reproduction is the normal thing. And he would preach for an hour on that. Using the parallel, but spiritual reproduction can take place much quicker than physical reproduction. At a meeting one night we had from the servicemen, our speaker was Irwin Moon, Sermons from Science preacher. And Dawson Trotman and I were in the back of the room. These 35 or 40 sailors, I guess. And he asked me to stand back there with him so we could notice anybody who responded to the invitation. And as Irwin Moon gave the invitation, a fellow I'd brought over named Tom Ridley, Irwin asked him to stand to the feet if they wanted to receive Christ. And kind of packed in the little living room there. As Tom Ridley got up, he had to kind of push the fellow next over to him, you know, to kind of pull himself out. And Dawson and I were standing there in the back of the room watching. And the fellow next to him, when he saw old Tom stand up, he kind of looked up, you know, and then down, looked up. And then after about two or three seconds, He stood up. Dawson Trotman whispered in my ear, "A man doesn't have to be a Christian very long before he can influence somebody else, does he?" That's right. If my friend is going to receive Christ, probably not 10 seconds later. Spiritual reproduction doesn't make as long as physical reproduction. Principle number one. Principle number two. In most cases, the degree of maturing, is directly related to the amount of personal individual time that's given to the individual Christian. And I want to expand on that a little bit. It isn't fair for us to try to imitate Christ, I don't think. But Paul was a human being, and it's fair for us to try to imitate him. In 1 Thessalonians 2:11, after commending the Thessalonians for the fact that their testimony was known throughout the world, he gave a clue as to why. In 1 Thessalonians 2:11, and I like the New English translation, "There are those who say..." The Navigators had a lobbyist on the scene when that translation was made. Because Paul said, "I dealt with you as a parent does his children, one by one." The first time I saw that, I laughed aloud. It was so amusing to me. And you parents can appreciate this. I thought, I missed out on something in raising our family. What we should have done was to keep a diary every hour from the first time our first child was born. No, for the first 2 years. Then when the second one is born, you just take the diary and duplicate everything you did with the first one every hour on every anniversary day. Right? Now, parents, wouldn't that work great? Wouldn't that take a lot of strain out of the second and third one? You just refer to the diary, do the same thing. Would that work? Why wouldn't it work? Their needs are different. There is not any hour of any day that the needs of the second is the same as the first. Right? With Christians, the same way. Everyone is an individual. Paul said, "Well, the contribution I made to your testimony reaching the whole world was that I only spent a few days there, but I dealt with you, everyone, one by one, just the way a parent does a child." I'm just going to quote one page from this book, page 77, Book Doss. "The circumstances of recruiting Spencer to Minutemen confirmed Dawson's growing conviction that more could be accomplished for God by building in depth in one life than by scattering shot in all directions." He added to a quotation in his Bible, "Action is no substitute for production." I want to be careful not to give any details, but we have some Christian brothers behind the Iron Curtain. And a message recently came through from one of them. During the Stalinist era, things were so restricted, we couldn't even meet together in each other's homes, but we could take a walk. And he said, during those years, I trained 7 or 8 young men as we took a walk day after day. Then he said things loosened up, and we opened our homes for meetings. And he said, "You know, I haven't reproduced anybody since then. That's the reason we're glad for the Navigator influence, to get us back to that which works. Personal individual, time, and training. I have a friend who's a squadron commander, Navy pilot. We were talking one day about this matter of groups one by one. He said, I haven't got time to concentrate on one person. I want to speak to as many as I can every time I get up. You navigators are kind of out of your gourd on this. But I've noticed, whereas your people stick and multiply, mine don't. Maybe you've got something there. What is it? So I said, Hal, let me tell you about your Navy training to be a jet pilot. And I went through it, came to the point where I said, one day the instructor said, okay, fellas, you've been in the classroom for about a year now. This is graduation day. 30 jets out on the runway. Each of you go crawl in one, take off. I want to see what I've taught you. He said, oh, no, that's not the way it happened. I said, how did it happen? A pained expression came on his face. That pilot instructor, he was on my back from morning till night. He said, you'll never learn to fly. You're going to kill both of us. Oh. I said, are you telling me that the Navy assigned to you a Lieutenant J.G., Lieutenant Commander, and his whole job was to teach you to fly that jet? Well, he was way ahead of me. Yeah, I see what you mean. And I said, you know, Hal, you can judge the importance of any task by the amount of personal individual effort and attention that goes into it. There's no greater task than building Christians who can reproduce. And our second principle here is that it takes a considerable amount of personal individual attention. Now, really what I'm trying to talk about here is what we've learned. Navigator history. God's interested in you. And I hope that you see a parallel between what Jesus Christ did that resulted in the world being reached for 200 years and what God raised up Dawson Trotman to do. Is there a parallel there between them? I think that there is. Now, just two or three more things here. Truth number 8. The Navigator organization is now operating in 30 countries with about 1,200 staff, of whom 300 are representatives. Truth number 9 is that we have assigned a point system and a priority status to 150 countries, and we hope by 1990 to have the Navigator ministry in every country of the world. Observation number 2. God is more interested in the Navigator's movement than the Navigator organization. Christianity is a movement. The Navigators is a sub-movement. Most of you will never be a part of the Navigator organization. But I'd sure like to recruit you to the Navigator movement. The history of movement shows that to be successful, a movement needs to be carried on by fellow travelers who are not a part of the organization or accountable to it. 7 communists started a movement a half century ago and now dominate a third of the world. Less than 2% of the communists in the world are card-carrying members. This movement is furthered by fellow travelers who carry out the objectives of the organization without being a part of it or accountable to it. Bob Foster is not a member of the staff of the Navigators. But I don't know anybody that more vigorously is carrying out the objectives of the Navigators as a part of the movement. Walden Scott, the leader of World Evangelical Fellowship, is not a staff member of the Navigators. But I don't know anybody that's promoting the movement any more vigorously throughout the world than Walden Scott. Joe Coggeshall, a retired Navy chief, is not a member of the Navigators organization. But throughout CBMC in the U.S., he is really furthering the objectives of the Navigator organization through this movement. Now to conclude with a couple of suggestions, and I think this will add up to 18 when we get all through here. Suggestion number one, if you're not already, get involved in this New Testament movement. Get involved. Suggestion number two. Make a list of 20 people you know, Christian and non-Christian. Pray for them daily. And as the door opens, share your life and message with them. Concentrate on a few who can multiply the same way that Christ did. Now, I'm running out of time, and I've got to wind up here. But I'd like to drive this last idea home. The population of the earth is increasing at the rate of 8,000 per hour. So if we're in this auditorium for an hour, there'll be 8,000 more people, and more than that born, subtract the ones who died from those born, 8,000 more. Physical multiplication is going on. The only way to catch up is through spiritual multiplication. Communists started out with 7, half century ago, a third of the world. Christ started out with really 11. Next 200 years, Christianity dominated the world. If this is such a hot idea, and the solution is so simple, why doesn't everybody do it? Now, this is the practical part of our suggestion number two. There are two reasons why every Christian isn't doing it. Number one is a feeling of inferiority on the part of Christians who say, well, I'm not that well qualified. I'm not that squared away myself. I can't help somebody else. I think about the very successful dog trainer who was asked what the secret of his success was. As he thought for a little bit, he said, well, in the first place, you got to know more than the dog. Well, I think you get the point. You could write down in the next 5 minutes 20 people that you know more than they do, couldn't you? Now, don't use that for an excuse that you're not ready and you don't know enough. You know more than most of the people that you're in touch with about Jesus Christ. Now, number two, and this is the real vulnerable thing. You know, and I know, that when we start sharing our lives and the things of the Word of God with an individual, the time is bound to come that that person will say to you or to me, if that's such a great idea, how come you're not doing it? You know what I mean? Anybody know what I mean? So, you say, I got to be the giant pace setter and have every area of my life covered before I can start. No. There's no such thing as a perfectly well-rounded person. Don't wait till you're a pace setter in every area. And when that time comes that the person says, if that's such a great idea and biblical, why don't you do it? You say, well, this is where you can help me. You pray for me that we'll get on with this together. Now, my third suggestion is keep in touch with someone who can help you in your stage of growth and need. That's the key to being able to help some others. Well, I've tried to tie in a little Bible, a little bit of Navigator history. You know, an application of Navigator history. A lot of good details in here. I want to conclude with one incident. David, I don't know whether this happened when you were in the service men's department or not. But one day, we got a letter from a chaplain in Spain, stationed at an Air Force base. And he told a little about his career as a chaplain. And he said, every place I've been, I've had a group of young men that helped out in the chapel program. Oh, they were great. And he said, you know, when I checked up, I found out they'd been in touch with the Navigators. But he said, I'm here at this new Air Force base in Spain, and there are no airmen that have been in touch with the Navigators. Now, could you send me a book that I can give them that'll make them be like these other guys that I've had at the other Air Force bases? I know you put out literature. You know, send us some literature, books, so we can get those kind of men. Well, I had a lot of fun answering that letter. And it was a three-pager, I think, one I answered. I said, Chaplain, we don't have any books that we can send you that will give this kind of a product. But I can tell you how to get this kind of a product. You pick out of your chapel the young man that you think is the most likely. You have a meeting with him. And then you talk to him about Bible study. Show him how you do it, what you do, and then start doing it with him. And then talk to him about a quiet time. And then you have a quiet time with him. Teach him how to do it. Tell him about your call to the ministry and teach him how to share his faith with others. And then I went through a few other things in the three pages that are familiar to many of you. I said, Chaplain, that's the only way you're going to get that kind of a man, by sharing your life personally. And if you've had the good fortune to have these kind of people in the past, it's not because of books and literature alone. It's because somebody took the time to do what I've just suggested to you in this letter that you do. So, we're in the spiritual big leagues this morning. My challenge to you and suggestion is get active in the movement that worked in the first few centuries, the one that God has called into existence. Start a chain of spiritual reproduction.